Welcome to Beyond the Black Box. Before we can move beyond the black box, let's talk about what it is. B.F. Skinner first referenced the mind as a black box with the belief that it should not be studied because without being observable or completely objective, it would be unscientific. And as such, behaviorism as a learning theory focuses on the observable inputs and outputs, and everything else is shrouded within that black box and need not be examined. The learning theories go beyond behaviorism, for example, constructivism or cognitivism, which views thought processes as equally, if not more important, than observable behavior. That's not to say we should abandon behaviorism, but rather view learning as the big picture. And the learning theories are like lenses of a microscope that help us to zoom in on different layers of that picture. Each one plays a different role, and at some point in time, one element may be more relevant than another. But if we only focus on one learning theory, we may be missing important aspects of that larger picture. Now, I don't pretend to be an authority in this area. I'm not a scientist, though I look to science to inform the choices that I make when practically applying training strategies. And I believe that we have to also be able to acknowledge the limitations of what science has currently proven and balance what we don't know with informed intuition and assumptions made on the basis of logical progressions. And we weigh that against the potential for doing harm. What I think today is based on what I know today, and I have to be open to the fact that what I think may be different based on what I've come to know in the future. Animal training as a whole is heavily rooted in behaviorism, and my hope is to share with you some of the ways that I've come to find myself looking beyond the black box. We often talk about the importance of addressing emotion in animal training. Because when we change emotion, we change behavior. And as an industry, this was a huge shift from the human-centric perspective that necessitated punishment of behavior that we deemed bad. And we began to peel back the curtain on possibilities for modifying behavior beyond the four quadrants. But I believe that we've only begun to scratch the surface with regard to how we address the intersection of the learner's experience and the learning process. For example, we know that animals have the capacity to anticipate and to form expectations of the future. If they didn't, training via learned associations to extrapolate probable future patterns would not work. If the dog could not anticipate that when they sit by the cookie jar, they might get a cookie, they wouldn't do it. And clearly, they have the ability to utilize probability to rationalize the what-ifs in their world. Because if the dog didn't get a cookie that time or the time after, do they stop sitting by the cookie jar? Sometimes, but we also know the power of what if from the well-documented success of intermittent and variable reinforcement schedules. So, if an animal can anticipate outcomes, even those that may be less likely, it's not a leap to suggest that they may make false assumptions regarding the possible outcomes or the probability of those outcomes. In humans, we call the problematic ways in which we frame information cognitive distortions, which includes things like jumping to conclusions, overgeneralization, and catastrophizing. Cognitive distortions are rooted in negativity bias, which is the tendency to focus on or remember negative feelings or events as more impactful, even when positive events were of equally proportionate intensity. We know that dogs also experience negativity bias, as do many species, and one example study in which this was observed was published in 2017 called Investigating Emotional Contagion in Dogs to Emotional Sounds of Humans and Conspecifics. It seems then that there's a great likelihood that animals may experience this phenomena too. So if we acknowledge that possibility, how would that inform behavioral change? If a dog experiences anxiety because when they see a stranger, they anticipate that that stranger will turn toward them and begin to move in their direction, and an interaction that they'd rather avoid is inevitable, then how might these expectations amplify their experience of emotions like fear that might be a motivating condition for behaviors like barking or lunging? And when we use classical conditioning, how can we be certain that the emotion is changing solely as a result of the targeted and imposed associations, such as see stranger, get food? Is it possible that in some spaces, behavioral change could be the result of observing and learning from a breakdown in the functionality or legitimacy of their anticipatory belief systems, and that the treat is cool bonus rather than the catalyst? Could we more efficiently facilitate changes in emotional responses by creating space for this possibility and training. And by now you might be thinking, well, the dog can't tell me what they're thinking, so we work with what we've got. But we don't have to know what these false expectations are to counteract them. Playing cognitive whack-a-moles is inefficient, as routinely addressing undesirable behaviors, focusing on the countless unproductive possibilities over the limited productive ones. We can act to combat the potential for these predictions, not by acknowledging what will not be, but rather by modeling what will be. The real world is unpredictable, erratic, random, and uncontrollable. And as such, it does not provide the ability to explore the potential for false beliefs in a meaningful way. We have to carefully craft environments that allow for the right kind of exploration of the possibly meaningful elements, while guaranteeing safety and consistent replicable outcomes, to allow the animal to explore and discover new expectations. We can't tell them what to think, but we can carefully craft a learning experience to ensure that they receive the intended information through whatever pathway they choose. And this type of teaching is at the forefront of human learning experiences, a learner-centered approach. It's not new or groundbreaking in theory or practice in the human realm, but it is so foreign to us in animal training. So what would that look like? How would we do it? Well, first, we have to find a way to allow the animal to lead the experience without guiding them, because we cannot both listen and tell at the same time, which is an entirely different dilemma that I could cover in another episode or series of episodes. But my first goal in enacting this has so far been to craft strategies for providing the animal with the ability to communicate preferences, to exert control over their own responses to any situation that arises in that structured environment. If I can't know why you feel a particular way, I want to know what you choose to do about it. So let's say, for example, that we're working with a dog that has a potential to bark or lunge or otherwise escalate their behavior. We have to guarantee safety first and foremost, so utilizing a leash may be non-negotiable. And I used to believe that using restraint would limit the ability to explore and exert the necessary control for this to work, but that belief prevented me from crafting solutions to this dilemma. Rather than dismissing it as impossible, I wanted to find a way to provide freedom, to provide choice and communication while restrained. Because if we can rectify these seemingly opposing ideas, the possibilities are endless. So when a person holds the leash, they're often the one driving the walk, intentionally and unintentionally, often exerting their influence in many ways beyond that which we actively notice. So a few years ago, I thought to myself, what if we turn this on its head? Let's teach the dogs how to lead and the humans how to truly follow. What would it do if we went from saying, I need you to buckle your seatbelt before I drive, in the way that we frequently do when we request eye contact or heel position before we embark on a walk that we then control? And instead, we showed the dog how to utilize each of the controls in order to operate and drive the walk. How do you get the human to start moving, to stop moving, to turn, to change directions? How do you park the human so that they'll wait there, allowing you to explore the radius of the leash, knowing that the human will stay there, right where you left them? How does that give space to focus fully on the world around you and make intentional choices to direct the human behavior that you're anchored to? And how can we teach this without you having to learn through the frustrating process of trial and error and experimentation, and instead teach you each of the controls and then allow you to construct what you want out of that? If we threw out all expectation, what would happen? And universally, I've seen dogs make wildly unexpected choices after becoming rapidly skilled at driving the walk according to their preferences. And I blame this on the fact that our pets enjoy so little, if not no, control over anything. It's similar to when we ask kids what they would do if they became principal for a day. The answers are often unexpected or silly at first, but if they remain in a position of having more control over their experience, then the novelty wears off and we can quickly fall back into a functional routine. And I often see pushback on topics of consent and control with gross exaggerations about what could go wrong. And so my answer to that is, I know what could go wrong, so I design it carefully to ensure that it will go right. Very simplistically, we might start by introducing this at home, in a living room or a backyard, where the human holding the leash feels safe to allow the dog to make choices, where the worst that can happen is that they decide to turn left around the sofa when maybe you wanted to head toward the kitchen. We have to acknowledge that we aren't saying that the dog is now in absolute control at all times, and that they could lead you into a busy highway and you must allow it, because that's ridiculous. But we can create a space where it's safe to have some amount of control for some amount of time. Maybe it's 5 minutes in which you set aside your desire to go grab a glass of water, and you allow your dog to show you the parts of your home that they find the most interesting. Where would they take you? We're not talking about absolute agency, where the dog can now do everything that their heart desires all on their own. We're talking about enabling proxy agency, which is defined by psychologist Albert Bandura as influencing others who have the resources, knowledge, and means to act on their behalf to secure the outcomes they desire. As the other end of the leash and otherwise custodian of our dog's universe, we always have veto power. We can always choose not to oblige a request, but that places a new onus on us to justify putting up those roadblocks. And in turn, it develops awareness of our reflexive tendency to do so when perhaps it isn't justified. So not surprisingly, dogs often become calmer when I begin to incorporate these systems. And as handlers become comfortable with the concept, knowing they have full authority to override the system, usually in the first or second session, we begin to craft a contextual space that I refer to as dress rehearsal. It looks, sounds, and feels like the real world, but it isn't. It's a version of the real world that we control, so we know the bad things can't happen in this space, and it makes room for the learner to explore a variety of potential options while ensuring that our deal-breaker options are inaccessible, and I'll explain that a little more in a minute. Crafting this environment can vary significantly from what we choose to use, where, when, and how we set it up. It's a space crafted around an individual, and personalization is imperative. But in all circumstances, it involves some form of fake approximation of the real world. And in my experience, this is the most common point at which people become hung up. I can't tell you how many times I've heard, "My dog will know it's fake." And first of all, fake is a uniquely human construct. We invented manufacturing. We have intimate knowledge of our capabilities of crafting a false representation of another thing. The animals simply do not. Everything in their world is real to them, though perhaps real in different ways. A dog may not respond in the same way to the inflatable dog, not because they've identified its fakeness, but because it behaves differently than their known experience of other dogs. The inflatable dog is still, quiet, and predictable. Is it possible that what approximations of a trigger lack are what enables comfort, exploration, curiosity, and feelings of safety as they embark on their journey of exploration and discovery in this context? Much like the lack of audience in a dress rehearsal, the lights are on, the stage is set, but the audience is not there, so the pressure is off, and the possibility of making mistakes lacks the same level of potential risk. We could, for example, place the fake dog at a distance, and now that we've established a system for the dog to drive through intentional choices, we can gather information about how they would prefer to react to that change in the environment by observing what they choose. And in my experience, dogs enter dress rehearsal space much calmer when they have control than they do the real world. We can step back and allow them to make choices about whether they'd like to avoid or investigate, and all are acceptable and safe options. And the communication system is designed to leave no space for deal breaker or unsafe behaviors like barking or lunging, because if the dog wanted space, they're empowered to take it. And so now we have a comfortable middle ground that provides context where we can model experiences that we might frequently encounter and manufacture ideal outcomes for the animal to explore. So for example, we might ask a family member that the dog knows and trusts to walk the fake dog up and down the sidewalk across the street, repeating a predictable and consistent pattern. Meanwhile, the dog we're working with is free to direct us away from or toward the fake dog they can observe or approach, because the worst thing that can happen in this experience is nothing. This space allows them to explore the reality of their expectations without us having to directly address those expectations or even know what they are. Beyond that, the dogs show us what they need to cope, such as when they need space and where they would go, and when we listen, they become more relaxed, comfortable, and curious. We're also so often wrong with the best intentions. We may think a dog wants to move away, so we make a habit of jumping in with a magnet hand, for example, and guiding them away with food. But perhaps that could breed frustration in a dog that wants to be able to observe. And more often than not, we can easily change our behavior to better support them simply by opening a line for input and utilizing it. And there will be times when we have to negotiate. It may not be safe to let a dog observe another that's on a collision course towards them. But the ability for your dog to provide input can diminish the impact of moments in which you retake control by increasing the value in the negotiation, by providing greater accuracy of what's important to them. We make assumptions with good intentions, like I'm giving you a treat and therefore this will feel good. But if I wanted a paycheck and every payday I was gifted a cake, I might enjoy cake occasionally, but after a while I might become frustrated in anticipation of receiving cake that I don't want. I might try to avoid accepting the cake. And if your bargaining chip for negotiating with me was cake, it would quickly lose value. Knowing the dog prefers to observe allows me to create dress rehearsal space to show the dog how to access what they tell us they need. We could ask that known and trusted family member to walk the fake dog toward us, just as another might. And as they're approaching, we might step out of the path while calling to the dog, however careful not to pull or physically manipulate them. And the first few times, the dog might blow off the handler entirely and choose to watch or even crowd or sniff the fake dog as it approaches and passes. But if that happens, nothing has to change. I don't need to tell them that it's not allowed because in this space, here, in this moment, it is, because it doesn't hold risk. I don't need to impose a right and a wrong answer. And maybe because the dog expected something to happen when they explored the fake dog. We don't have to know what that is. But allowing a degree of freedom where safety is guaranteed to allow them to explore and dismiss something that may or may not exist seems to flip a switch that we don't have to label or operate, but that clears space for new information to take hold. And this often happens rather quickly because we can manufacture experiences in predictable, consistent, repetitive ways, so they occur at a much greater rate than they would in the real world. Within the course of a few minutes, the dog may have experienced several passes, the first five of which they ignored the handler completely, and by the sixth pass, they started to move with the handler, at which point they received an extra bonus treat and got to observe from a safe distance. Here they have a choice between crowding and observing, or moving away and observing with a bonus treat. We allow them to explore crowding because we can guarantee that it will be anticlimactic. There are no unique smells to take in or acknowledgments from the fake dog or familiar person, so we don't have to make that choice inaccessible. They explored it and dismissed it, and maybe find that they can receive the same access to information plus a treat by moving away. So soon they're moving out of the path of the approaching dog before we even need to prompt them. And maybe now we can open up even more choices. Which direction would you like to go in moving away? How soon? How far do we go? And more. So constructing and learning environments removes the necessity for framing information as an either-or in reaching a predetermined goal, and it may allow for a variety of paths towards the same destination. Now, because the dog was allowed to explore the what if, they show significantly less hesitation when being asked to move away and are drastically less resistant to suggestions from the handler because the negotiation has changed. We were able to consider what is important to the dog. Where before the experience was add treat, lose proximity, and lose ability to observe while eating treat, now they're losing proximity, but we've preserved the ability to choose to observe and access a treat if desired. An easy factor to otherwise overlook that allowed us to reach our goals much more quickly and with less conflict. And we never had to know why. I find that not only do management strategies become more effective, but the frequency and magnitude in which they're needed plummets. I feel we've barely scratched the surface on these concepts, and more, and I'm eager to dive in further. I may find in a few years' time that I was wrong, but if we explore safely without posing a risk to our animal or human students, and from an ethos of do no harm, then why shouldn't we? If it doesn't help, it didn't hurt. And so far, the benefits that I've seen have been incredible. But maybe we prove down the road that these benefits can be attributed to something else, but at least we found them. But if you're still listening and you share my excitement to look at our existing strategies from new perspectives and explore new frontiers, check out the R+ 2.0 collaborative community, a space in which we hope to foster these conversations. I'd love to hear your thoughts.